So there's a lot of CME out there, but how much of it truly is clinically valuable and free of commercial influence? And that's what makes Oakstone CME stand out. Whether you're listening to ACP MixApp Audio Companion or diving into their board prep content, everything is expert-led, evidence-based, no ads, no fluff. Their content is developed in collaboration with leading medical institutions, and it shows. Material is sharp, practical, packed with clinical pearls you get right away. I've definitely walked away from episodes with insights that I've actually been able to apply that same week. And there's something for everyone. Over 30 specialties to choose from with case-based reviews and real-world relevance built in. If you're looking for trusted, no BS CME that actually helps you practice, check out Oakstone CME. Use the code CORE30 for 30% off from November 1st to January 31st, 2026. This is exclusive to Corian listeners. If you go to oakstone.com/MKSAP, that's oakstone.com/MixApp. And don't forget to use the code CORE30. And with that, let's get back into the episode.
We spend a disproportionate amount of time in medicine agonizing over decisions to give or remove fluids with either fluids or diuretics. Every low urine output prompts kind of this discussion about, should we be giving this patient fluids? And if we actually think about it at kind of the most simple level, IV fluids are just salt and water. Salt water hasn't and never will be the treatment for so many diseases. So I guess I just hope that in 2025 and beyond, we can stop kind of overestimating the perceived benefit of fluid and maybe just kind of focus more on the core things, like, have we addressed the underlying cause of sepsis?
That's Dr. Ross Pager, an intensivist and scientist who taught me a ton in this interview about the new advancements in assessing a patient's fluid status, something I know plagues a lot of us. And I was actually surprised to understand just how relevant venous congestion can be for anyone who takes care of patients in any setting, not just the ICU. And of course, definitely motivated me to up my ultrasound skills. So let's start with, what is venous congestion? What does that actually mean?
At the most core level, venous congestion is when high, actually, reversal of flow from the right atrium goes to the end organ, for example, kidneys, the liver, brain, the bowel even, and causes congestive organ injury. Now, this is a little bit different than volume overload, where there's too much actual physical, extracellular, or interstitial volume on the patient that could be manifesting as peripheral edema, pleural effusions, and just kind of general puffiness. The reason why this distinction is important is that patients can have severe venous congestion without volume overload. And in fact, some conditions like pericardial effusions, RV dysfunction can manifest primarily as congestion without concurrent volume overload. I think it's probably also just worth mentioning the other term that gets thrown around, volume status, which, to be quite honest, means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. I think for the most part, people use it as, do I need to diurese the patient, give them fluids, or do nothing? And it's kind of this holistic term, but because it means different things to different people, it's not particularly precise. And so I prefer more specific questions contained within that. For example, to start off, does this patient have microcirculatory organ dysfunction? Do they have signs of end organ dysfunction and hypoperfusion, clinical features of volume overload? Does this patient have venous congestion? And is that congestion on the left or the right side? Are they fluid tolerant? And fluid tolerance is this concept, would fluids and giving fluids to that patient actually harm them? And then do they have low stroke volume? And is that low stroke volume going to be responsive to fluids or potentially even vasopressors? And so when you break down a generic term like volume status into these subcomponents, you can start having more precise conversations and weighing the risks and benefits of fluids or Lasix or any other hemodynamic intervention you might use.
These are all good questions to ask yourself when someone throws around the term, you know, follow up on volume status. And we'll get into these more a little bit later. But for now, what we need to cement is that venous congestion is different from volume overload. Venous congestion is this retrograde reversal of flow from the right atrium to end organs. And this is different from overt volume overload, where you might see peripheral edema. This distinction is important because you can have a patient with venous congestion, but without volume overload. Take, for example, a patient with right ventricular dysfunction who is having venous congestion at the organ level, but not having signs of overt volume overload. Or, as we'll learn about a little bit later, you can have a patient with septic shock and have venous congestion without overt volume overload. I think this brings us to, why do we even care? Why do we care that there is venous congestion happening at the organ level?
Well, it turns out that every organ actually has a perfusion pressure. The kidney, for example, has a renal perfusion pressure, which can be approximated as kind of the inflow pressure or your mean arterial pressure and the venous pressure or central venous pressure. And this is why actually when a patient's central venous pressure goes up, that's associated with adverse outcomes. So the problem is elevated central venous pressure for an individual patient in front of us doesn't have very strong predictive accuracy at predicting adverse outcomes. And there's a few reasons for that. One might be that the pressure at the right atrium or the central venous pressure does not actually reflect the pressure that's being felt by the organs, which are obviously distal to it. There's other factors, intrathoracic pressure, intra-abdominal pressure, compliance of the venous system. But perhaps more importantly, and what we're starting to really think, is that it's less about pressure and more about flow. And that it perhaps is more this retrograde flow that people experience during venous congestion that might drive the organ dysfunction.
Yeah, that's interesting. How do you distinguish, like, it's not the pressure as much the flow?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that there's been a lot of studies that have associated elevated venous pressures with adverse outcomes like acute kidney injury across critically ill patients, patients with sepsis. But it turns out when in the same study, when you actually look at end organ Doppler markers of congestion that actually detect the flow abnormalities in the kidney or the liver, those are even more correlated with adverse outcomes. For patients with sepsis, for example, venous congestion is associated with an increased hazard for requiring renal replacement therapy or death. For patients with heart failure, it's highly associated with acute kidney injury, but then also heart failure hospitalization and cardiac death. And then for patients with AKI that already have established acute kidney injury, venous congestion is highly associated with mortality. And so really the causal pathway for these patients is that venous congestion seems to cause multi-organ dysfunction that contributes to increased need for organ support in the intensive care unit, and then ultimately mortality. We're studying right now in the intensive care unit the implications of venous congestion on delirium. And it turns out that venous congestion is associated with cerebral desaturations and worse delirium plus cardiac surgery. And so maybe some of these patients that we have on medicine or in the intensive care unit are severely delirious, and we're not too sure why, because they're not on any meds or metabolic cycle gait. Maybe the treatment for those patients is actually diuresis. And I just really want to encourage people to think about this kind of domain of organ injury, congestive organ injury, as something we're increasingly recognizing is probably more pathogenic in many of our populations than we previously realized.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you ground us in, like, what are the painful situations where you're like, I am so glad we have Doppler, VEXIS?
I think that my favorite use case for venous congestion Doppler and venous congestion assessments is acute kidney injury. Patients where you're not sure whether or not this hemodynamic acute kidney injury is because they're actually hypovolemic or they're actually congested. And now, I think in an ideal world on the textbook, it's always easy to distinguish, but we know from real life, it can actually be incredibly difficult to distinguish these patients. And having a starting point that says that this patient's congested and then following that over time, that is incredibly valuable. Also for patients with acute kidney injury, with cardiorenal syndrome, you think that they're congested, you start diuresing them. At some point, somebody's going to inevitably ask, could they be intravascularly dry? Maybe the sodium's climbing a little bit, the creatinine's climbing a little bit, and trying to determine when do you actually stop decongesting a patient. Having baseline and then trended markers of congestion is incredibly valuable. For patients with acute sepsis or even just acute shock in general, venous congestion can also be quite helpful to assess. And so, for example, in our local data in septic shock, 20% of patients when they're admitted to the ICU have severe venous congestion with septic shock. Early on in their course, these patients actually arguably could be harmed by additional IV fluids. Many of them have RV dysfunction and biventricular failure. And perhaps the treatment for these patients is actually not more fluids, but a fluid restrictive strategy, potentially even Lasix, decongestion with inotropes and vasopressors. And that's what we're really interested in, is how can we sub-phenotype these patients with septic shock, for example.
And let's just, because I was so surprised to hear that this being invoked for patients who are septic, because, you know, you think of them as like, give them fluids, they have infection. But in these patients as septic shock who have severe congestion, is it they always have some type of RV dysfunction that's causing that? Or is it something with the milieu of inflammatory response?
That's such a good question. I think this is the most important take-home point probably for venous congestion. Venous congestion is not just related to volume. Venous congestion is really the interplay between cardiac function and the loading conditions for the right side. And let's just think about it from the left side of the heart. And we're very familiar with this. We have patients in the community with EFs of 10% who are walking around who have no pulmonary congestion at all. They're dry.
Mm-hmm.
They have cardiac dysfunction, but because their preload condition is optimized through diuretics and heart failure therapy, they don't have pulmonary congestion. Yet, when that patient comes to hospital with sepsis and gets 3 liters of fluid empirically, now suddenly they're in florid pulmonary edema. They have the substrate for congestion, which is now manifested after receiving IV fluid. The same thing happens on the right side. You have a patient with a substrate for developing venous congestion. Maybe that's RV systolic or diastolic dysfunction, elevated PA pressures, pericardial diseases or pericardial effusions, tricuspid regurg, and then interplaying in with their acute illness and the volume and resuscitation they get for that, they now manifest organ dysfunction and venous congestion on the right side. And there's a lot of different causes of venous congestion. It's not just cardiac either. So for example, we know that patients that go on higher PEEP on the ventilator can develop right-sided congestion if they're over-distended. And in fact, titrating PEEP can actually help improve renal function for those patients. We know that patients with large pleural effusions can have severe venous congestion. And I think back to a case that we had where a patient had really, really bad renal failure in this massive right-sided pleural effusion, but they weren't on much oxygen. We put a chest tube and drained that pleural effusion and immediately saw improvement of the severe renal congestion and improvement of their acute kidney injury just from draining that pleural effusion. We know that patients can have elevated intra-abdominal pressure, and elevated intra-abdominal hypertension also cause renal dysfunction. And we've seen also patients that have IVC stenoses, for example, post-liver transplant, that have severe renal congestion, and it's not at all related to the heart at this point. It's due to a proximal upstream occlusion from a thrombus. And so we saw this thrombus on ultrasound. Actually, and the patient went back to the OR for kind of a thrombectomy for that and immediately had their renal function recover.
Awesome. So thank you for clarifying, you know, the pain points where we are maybe invoking some type of venous congestion. So how does one measure venous congestion, and what in the world is VEXAS?
Yeah. And I think it's even helpful just to take a step back from that. So we're so familiar with left-sided physiology. We think about it all the time on medicine. So let's start there. When you have a patient with elevated left atrial pressure, that gets transmitted retrograde into the lungs. It causes pulmonary edema. And we can detect that on ultrasound with B-lines, wrong chest x-ray, curly B-line, bat wing, all the normal stuff. Turns out this is very similar to the right-sided physiology. Elevated retrograde atrial pressure, it's transmitted retrograde, causes organ-level congestion, but the organs we're talking about now are the brain, the bowel, the liver, and the kidney for the most part. This can be detected by Doppler at those organs. So traditional tools to quantify venous congestion, like central venous pressure measurement, examination of the JVP, are really, really limited because those are pressure estimates. And we've just talked about how flow is probably more important than pressure. And then also, even if you are looking at them as accurate metrics, there's a lot of variability. Even for CVP, which is something that we assume is very repeatable, you just transduce it, there's a lot of inter-rater reliability issues there. And similarly for JVP, and we know that there's such significant issues with inter-rater reliability for JVP.
And do we have an understanding of like what type of patients might have a more compliant venous system versus a more tight one?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So that's actually a little bit where the IVC measurement comes in to play. Because if your IVC is super distended, you have, by definition, not a very compliant system anymore because it's already full and stretched to kind of the maximum capacity. Versus if you have a totally collapsed IVC, that may be a patient that has some more compliance. And if you fill up more kind of fluid in there, and if the pressure is higher, it might not be transmitted retrograde. Which is a great segue into how do we actually measure it now on ultrasound. And so initially, venous congestion was quantified using individual Doppler markers. So for example, after cardiac surgery, the group in Montreal, André Deneau, William Bobier-Souvigny, they looked at patients with post-cardiac surgery and examined their portal veins. And they found that portal vein pulsatility was associated with adverse outcomes, particularly acute kidney injury, but also delirium and congestive encephalopathy following cardiac surgery. In the heart failure population, a lot of the early work was done looking at intrarenal venous Doppler. So actually looking at the kidney and looking at these tiny little interlobular vessels, because the artery and the vein, they run right together. And you can pulse wave Doppler these vessels that run together and look at flow abnormalities there. And then in acute kidney injury, we've looked at it using multiple different metrics. Hepatic vein, portalvein and intravenal venous Doppler. But the problem is that each of these in isolation have some limitations. There are certain conditions that over-exaggerate some Doppler markers, and actually there's other conditions that dampen some of the others. And so in 2020, Dr. Bogna-Solini and Dr. Deneau in Montreal, they said, well, how could we combine multiple different measurements into one kind of scoring system? And they took the inferior vena cava, hepatic vein, portal vein, and intrarenal venous Doppler, and they put it into something called the VEXAS score that's become quite popular in the most recent years. And it's a score that ranges from 0 to 3, with scores of 2 or 3 representing kind of moderate to severe congestion. And this was derived and validated post-cardiac surgery. And what they found was that compared with central venous pressure and compared with any of the individual Doppler markers by themselves, there was improved predictive accuracy to predict acute kidney injury. Now, how did they choose the thresholds of portal vein pulsatility and abnormalities? You got to start somewhere. So they just picked reasonable numbers and they looked at their data and picked reasonable numbers. And so actually in my practice, I don't use the VEXAS score at all in our research or in kind of my assessment, because it was derived in one population. We're studying a different population. It was derived in the post-cardiac surgery population. And so we're interested in sepsis. Who is to say that the thresholds of congestion in sepsis are the same as in cardiac surgery? And so for our large international prospective study that we're just wrapping up right now, we're actually revalidating to look at, for each of these markers, what is the threshold that causes congestion in this population? And do we actually need all these different components? Or maybe the portal vein is one vein to rule them all, so to speak, and will actually have the same predictive accuracy as a more comprehensive score and is much easier to do, for example, than the intrarenal venous Doppler. And these are some of the questions that we have here.
So it sounds like there are 4 main components that we're going to be assessing: the IVC, the hepatic vein, the portal vein, and the intrarenal venous congestion. This can all help us identify congestion, even if we're not using the venous score to the T. I'm curious about common mistakes or blind spots people have when they're trying to learn how to measure venous congestion or interpret it.
Great question. And to be entirely honest, there's a lot. The first thing I see is that, understandably, people rely a lot on the VEXAS score. And for example, if the IVC is less than 2 centimeters on the VEXAS score, you actually don't proceed with any of the Doppler markers.
Oh, interesting.
It's a little bit challenging because we have a lot of data showing that patients with IVC smaller than 2 centimeters can have severe venous congestion. Stopping there is probably not a great idea. The next thing is trying to figure out the IVC and long axis, which is what is traditionally done in the VEXAS score and what we're traditionally taught at internal medicine and ICU POCUS. Well, it turns out that like any vein, the IVC is not actually round. And so, for example, if you go into the neck and you're putting in a central line as an internist, and if you see a very round structure that you're about to put a line into, stop, because there's a good chance that that's not the vein. We all know that the internal jugular is kind of this ellipsoid, it's partially flat. Well, the IVC is no different. It's a vein. It's ellipsoid. Mm-hmm. And so when you actually image it in long axis, you're assuming that the axis of this ellipsoid aligns perfectly with the long axis. But when you actually look at it in short axis, sometimes you see these bizarre IVCs that are like 4 centimeters in one diameter and like 2 millimeters in the other diameter. And if you catch that just right in long axis, you can falsely make it look really, really big or really, really small. And so we, for example, advocate for assessing IVC in short axis, because short axis, you can actually kind of look at the sphericity or how round it is, because we know that as veins get more distended, they get more round. So perhaps that's actually a better metric to assess the IVC, for example, than long axis. And that's something that we're currently studying.
Great.
Similarly, when we go to the hepatic vein, portal vein, and intrarenal vein, it can be hard to figure out what you're looking at. Particularly the hepatic vein. And so what I advocate for this is just kind of thinking a little bit more simplistically about it. Blood should flow forward. On hepatic vein Doppler, that's flow below the baseline. The more and more flow you have above the baseline, regardless of whether it's ASVD, your kidney doesn't care, the more congested you are. And so we're interested in thinking about hepatic vein Doppler a little bit more kind of simplicity, just saying how much is backwards, how much is forward. Don't worry about which waveform is which, because the more that you have retrograde, the worse congestion you probably have. I would say that the portal vein is probably my favorite. I mean, if I was going to pick favorites here, you shouldn't pick favorites among your children, but I would pick a favorite here with the ultrasound. It would definitely be the portal vein. If you go from the right upper quadrant, the main portal vein or the right portal vein comes right out towards you on the screen. you put Doppler on and you look at the pulsatility, which is just the maximum velocity minus the minimum velocity divided by the maximum velocity. It's repeatable. And interestingly, it seems to be the least affected by things like tricuspid regurgitation and other potential kind of confounders. And one of the reasons for that is when you actually think about the blood flow, it has to go from the right atrium into the IVC, into the hepatic vein, into the hepatic sinusoids, like through the liver parenchyma to make it into the portal vein. So if you're seeing pulsatility and reversal there, that can be a pretty good indicator of true kind of congestion. And then the last one is the intrarenal venous Doppler. And I really like the intrarenal venous Doppler. And the reason why is when you can get it, which is the biggest limitation, is that it's only kind of obtainable in about 90% of patients based on the literature. But if you can get it, it measures directly kind of renal congestion. And often when we're talking about congestion, we're talking about it in the setting of renal dysfunction, either a patient with AKI that we're trying to figure out or a patient that we're diuresing and their creatinine's going up. And if you're measuring congestion at the kidney level and there's severe congestion, that's a pretty good indicator that renal congestion is probably at play with whatever process is going on. And it's also able to be tracked over time very nicely because there's this concept of renal venous stasis index. And this might be getting a little bit into the weeds, but I think it's interesting. And so the idea is that normally veins should drain 100% of the cardiac cycle time. There should just be continuous venous drainage. But in settings of significant congestion, you start getting periods of interruption. And as those periods of interruption of venous flow get longer and longer and longer, your renal venous stasis index goes from zero, which is normal, up to 10% interruptions, 20%, 30%, all the way up to like 60 or 70%, where most of your cardiac cycle, there's no venous drainage. That's really bad. And going back to the compartment syndrome analogy, that lack of venous drainage leads to worsening congestion of the actual parenchyma, which swells within the capsule containing the kidney, causing worse venous drainage. And it's this kind of really negative feedback cycle, or actually really bad positive feedback cycle, I should say. So normal is zero. You and I should be normal. But some patients, their normal might not be zero. And so I always think of this with like EFs, for example. Like a normal EF is above 65%. Yet you can have a patient with an EF of 30%, and that's just their baseline. So you have some patients that have baseline congestion. And no matter how hard you diurese them or how aggressively you kind of manage their heart failure, they just will always have congestion. That's not to say that it's normal, but it's their baseline. And ideally, in an ideal world, it would be nice to fix that, but we can't always. And actually, this brings into a really interesting use case. For example, if you try to diurese people aggressively with severe TR, a severe primary tricuspid regurgitation, maybe from rheumatic disease, for example, you can never improve their intrarenal venous Doppler. Unless by diuresing them, you've actually unmasked that this was not primary TR and this was secondary TR. They have severe renal congestion forever. Their portal vein will normalize or partially normalize. And you can use that to track kind of decongestion, but never their intrarenal venous Doppler. But when you send them for like tricuspid clip or tricuspid repair, and you fix the tricuspid regurg, their creatinine normalizes. So just because we couldn't fix their congestive renal injury with diuresis didn't mean that it wasn't having an impact on organ function.
Yeah, that's great. I think for me, this just really hammers home that every patient is different and different conditions will affect each of these four differently. So it is good to have a little bit more nuanced understanding of what affects what. So thank you for going through each and laying down what the high level nuances for what we should be thinking could be at play. I've really started paying closer attention to what's in the products that we use at home, especially with little ones running around. And once you realize what's hiding in conventional cleaners, it's really hard to unsee. And that's why I've genuinely been using Branch Basics. And especially with the holiday season coming up, give the gift that really matters, health, right? Branch Basics is flipping the script. They have a starter kit that is plant and mineral based and basically replaces everything from your bathroom cleaner to your laundry detergent in just one concentrate. So you can use it for washing produce, to makeup brushes, you name it. And because it's refillable, each bottle ends up costing just about $2. Like, that's awesome. And so as someone who's trying to cut down on harmful exposure, I think this is a powerful and simple swap. It's gentle enough for babies and pets and also tough enough to handle real messes. And I've seen it over and over. And honestly, that peace of mind, worth it. So get yourself and your loved ones the gift of clean with Branch Basics. For a limited time, they're actually offering 15% off and free shipping on their premium starter kit when you use the code CORIM at branchbasics.com/CORIM. That's 15% off your order at branchbasics.com/CORIM with the promo code CORIM. And please support our show and tell them that we sent you. And with that, let's get into the episode. I remember seeing a colleague of mine walk into the Senate room after a tough night looking way more put together. And I thought, gosh, yeah, they are wearing FIGS. FIGS scrubs is specifically made for healthcare workers, doctors, residents, medical students, people like us who need our gear to work as hard as we do. FIGS scrubs are lightweight, they're breathable, they're stretchy, they have really thoughtful details that have won me over. Tons of pockets, yes, for all the snacks. They have snag-free zippers, antimicrobial fabric that helps keep things clean. And when there's so much to think about on any given shifts, our scrubs or what we're wearing should not be one of them. FIGS gets that and it shows. And with the holidays right around the corner, it's a perfect time to treat yourself to some fresh looks for the new year, which is great because FIGS just dropped a ton of new limited edition colors and styles for the season. And if you check them out, FIGS is actually offering 15% off your first purchase at wearfigs.com with a code FIGSRX. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX. And with that, let's get back to the episode. Now, back to something we said earlier, which was being more precise when people say volume overload and the idea of fluid tolerance. Let's talk more about that.
Definitely. I think fluid tolerance is one of the really important emerging concepts in acute care medicine. And the idea is that every treatment we do has a risk and a benefit. The benefit of giving somebody IV fluids, for example, is that we can increase their cardiac output. And by increasing their cardiac output and their stroke volume, we increase their perfusion, things get better. But like any treatment, there's a potential risk. And the risk of IV fluids is really multifactorial. You can cause congestive organ injury. You can cause pulmonary edema. You can cause tissue edema, which can lead to kind of this microcirculatory dysfunction. You can cause endothelial dysfunction from over-aggressive fluid resuscitation, actually like shredding the glycocalyx in the vessels. There's a lot of potential harms. And we just need a concept to describe those potential harms. And that's fluid tolerance. How I think about fluid tolerance is there's kind of a few different domains. So first is the acute illness that somebody's facing right now might make them more or less fluid tolerant. So for example, if you have a patient that comes in with acute decompensated heart failure, they're not fluid tolerant. We would never even think about giving those patients fluid to try to improve their organ dysfunction because they're in pulmonary edema and acute overloaded heart failure. There's other more subtle conditions, however, like pancreatitis, for example. People with acute pancreatitis, they might respond well to fluid in the short term, but in the long term are actually not very fluid tolerant because they third space a lot of that fluid. And that third space fluid leads to ARDS. It can lead to abdominal compartment syndrome and other complications. In these situations, I think about giving fluids kind of like tapping a credit card. You're at the bar with friends and you know what? You order a round of drinks for some friends and then you tap your credit card that night and everything's all good because you're going to pay it off in the morning. But the next night you go out again. And then you go out again. And before you realize that you have a drinking problem, you keep going out time and time again. And you keep tapping your credit card. Eventually, that bill is going to have to be paid. Otherwise, it's going to accumulate interest. Giving IV fluid boluses are a little bit like tapping your credit card. They definitely work in the short term to restore kind of forward flow. But you have to pay the price by mobilizing that fluid down the road. And you don't want to essentially have your credit card debt or your fluid debt build up so much that you actually get organ dysfunction as a result.
That's great. Excellent.
So with fluid tolerance, acute illness is kind of the first thing I think about. Then I think about chronic comorbidities. So we intuitively know that patients that have EFs of 5 to 10% or severe pulmonary hypertension are going to be much more, cautious with IV fluids because they're more likely to be harmed by it. And then finally, I consider things like congestion, and that can be left-sided congestion or right-sided congestion. So a patient with pulmonary edema is going to be less likely to be fluid tolerant. A patient with severe venous congestion and RV dysfunction is going to be less likely to be fluid tolerant because as we give them fluids, there's a chance that this worsens their congestive organ injury. And so integrating those three components is kind of how I approach fluid tolerance for patients when I'm trying to weigh the risks of potentially giving a fluid bolus.
Yeah. And then you also mentioned like you have somebody with a low stroke volume and you're kind of weighing to get fluids versus vasopressors and kind of how can better understanding Dopplers help you with that?
Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, this is one of the hardest questions that still remains in acute care resuscitation. When do you switch over from giving somebody fluid resuscitation into vasopressor? My assessment of whether or not I should go into fluids or vasopressor starts with the microcirculation. Do they have surrogates of hypoperfusion, prefill, elevated lactate, oliguria, some sort of marker that this patient's perfusion isn't? Because often, actually, we get called for these patients after 4 liters, but then you look at them, you're like, actually, your lactate's cleared, you're peeing. Let's not give you fluids or vasopressors right now. Like, you're just doing okay. But let's say the patient is hypoperfused, hypotensive. The purpose of giving a fluid bolus is to increase something called the mean systemic filling pressure. So the mean systemic filling pressure is actually the main driver of venous return and cardiac output in our body. And it's the difference between the mean systemic filling pressure and your right atrial pressure. And so when you give somebody a fluid bolus, we give it with the hope of increasing our mean systemic filling pressure to drive more venous return. And it works for that because when you give somebody a fluid bolus, it increases the volume inside the vessels. That causes higher pressure and increases venous return. But it turns out that that's not the only way to increase your mean systemic filling pressure because there's the other component, the compliance or the elastance of the vessel. And if you give somebody vasopressors, you can also squeeze the venous system and increase that mean systemic filling pressure and drive more venous return. And so whenever I think about giving a fluid bolus, I always ask myself, and I have a bit of a luxury being in the ICU where I don't have to kind of factor about resource utilization and transfer to kind of higher level beds. But I always ask myself, if this patient's hypoperfused, they have low stroke volume, they're acting hypovolemic, is the treatment for this patient fluid or is it actually vasopressors? Because maybe in this case, I could actually recruit some of that venous volume by just giving vasopressors. And so how does this relate to the venous congestion assessments? When I have a patient with severe venous congestion, who I'm worried that they are less fluid tolerant, that may push me to trial vasopressors earlier with the hope that I can recruit mean systemic filling pressure and kind of recruit that venous volume, increase forward flow without giving fluids. Because again, fluids are that credit card that I'm going to have to pay off down the road. And that patient already has signs that they're in too much debt, so to speak.
Yeah. Oh, that's so great. Thank you for kind of walking through all of that. And then back to DEXIS or just some of the four core measures of it, how often are you getting these measurements? Is it like a daily thing? Is it every other day? What in your practice do you find utility or would you recommend?
Yeah, great question. I would say that it really depends on the clinical scenario. And so I really like to anchor any hemodynamic assessment, be that DEXIS or cardiac assessments, in starting with the microcirculation. Mm-hmm. Is there organ dysfunction? Because if yes, we need to move on to figure out why and phenotype. So I would start by saying, whenever I have a patient in shock with organ dysfunction, I'm considering congestion as one of those mechanisms of organ dysfunction. Because we know that some of those patients have good forward flow, they have good MAP, but they have hypoperfusion due to congestion. So we need to sort of consider both the forward flow and the retrograde when assessing those patients. Question then becomes, well, when do you reassess? Well, it depends. If a patient, after we kind of initiate appropriate therapy, antibiotics, pressures on them with sepsis, for example, their organ dysfunction is getting better, you might not assess them again. Because if they don't have, if they have normal organ perfusion at this point, they're peeing at postorm, their pressures are coming down, their lactate's normalizing, what am I going to do differently if I find that they're still congested? I'm just going to keep doing what's working.
Yeah.
And so I often use it when patients are stalling, when there's uncertainty about which direction to go, or when there's ongoing hypoperfusion that hasn't been resolved. Because, for example, say we see a patient with sepsis with severe congestion and they're totally volume overloaded. We might start vasopressors and start diuresing them. But if 12, 24 hours later, they're still hypoperfused, it's not working. The question is, well, why are they so congested? Maybe they have occult RV dysfunction that we didn't recognize of. Maybe they have pulmonary hypertension as a driver of this kind of right-sided decompensation that we need to treat with inhaled nitric oxide, for example. So those would be the times that I'd start reassessing, but I don't routinely reassess on a prescribed schedule unless there's kind of a clinical picture for it.
I appreciate that. That's great.
I just give one more example that might be even more contextually relevant kind of for internal medicine listeners. It would be a patient with heart failure who is overloaded, who you start diuresing for cardiorenal syndrome and volume load. But having a baseline at the beginning is really helpful when on day 5, they're still overloaded, but their creatinine starts going up. and their urine output starts going down and you're starting to worry, gosh, could I have overdiuresed this patient? Or maybe their preload is actually too low. Having a repeat assessment at that time to say, no, this patient still has severe renal congestion. Instead of having the dose of Lasix you're holding and giving albumin, let's double the dose of Lasix and add some metolazone and really kind of double down on what we know and what we think should be working here.
To inspire the person who is, wow, this sounds so cool. How will I ever learn this? Or what do you have to say in terms of, this is like the meta in us, like how often should one practice? How should one practice to get somewhat competent in an evolving area?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing I would say is that, like, to put aside ultrasound. I think the first thing is just recognizing that congestive organ injury is probably more prevalent than you realize. So I would say that hopefully this kind of excites us to say that we have this kind of very prevalent phenotype of patients that have severe congestion and organ injury as a result of it. And I think if I was starting kind of really trying to get into this, I wouldn't start with VEXAS. VEXAS is like level two, level three. Start with just kind of core acquisition of POCUS images, the heart, the lungs. There's so many really important findings that can really change your clinical management in internal medicine and ICU based on ultrasound. And I would start there. And then as that skill set develops, then we can start looking at venous congestion and learning how to do the Doppler patterns. And they're really not that hard.
Any take-home points or things that you were like, I want people listening to get this out of the episode? Some final take-home points you have?
Yeah, a few final take-homes here. The first is that venous congestion is not a new concept. We've known about this for close to a century. But really excitingly, we now have tools available at our disposal to actually detect it. And to quantify it, but then monitor in response to treatment. And I think that this will really open up new areas of research in diseases that we manage every day. It'll add a lens and potentially an explanation for some of the reason why these patients do well or do poorly. And it may be related for some of these conditions to whether or not congested or not. The next thing is that congestion is separate from volume overload. Congestion reflects that interplay between cardiac function and the filling pressure. For some patients, they might be overloaded, like an acute decompensated heart failure with cardiorenal syndrome, and they might have severe venous congestion. But for other patients, the acute RV failure itself, the pericardial effusion, the pleural effusion, the intra-abdominal process going on can cause direct congestion. And then I think the final thing is just, and this is kind of the distinction between venous congestion and VEXAS, just because we have a new scoring system or a new tool to assess something that doesn't have a lot of evidence base doesn't mean that the concept and the theory behind it is new as well. And that's one criticism I've heard commonly of VEXAS is that, well, there's just not enough data. I totally agree. I don't use VEXAS in my own practice because there's not enough data for the populations that I'm using it in. But as a concept, congestion has been well established. And I think having that in your mind, regardless of how you assess it with Doppler or JVP or CVP or any other method that you choose, is still really valuable.
And that is a wrap for today. Our ask is that you send this to one colleague who might find learning about venous congestion or VEXAS helpful. Send it to someone who may be on the fence about learning ultrasound or even loves it already. Thank you again and take care.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.